The last time that I was speaking here, I talked a little bit at the start about worldviews. And each of you has a worldview, whether you realize that or not. There are probably, I would say, the three most common worldviews here, maybe not the only ones, are that you might be a Christian. You might already believe the central claims of Christianity. That might be part of your worldview. Alternatively, you might believe in God, but not embrace the main teachings of Christianity. And that will shape your view on all sorts of things. The fact that you still believe in God will shape maybe how you think about your priorities in life, perhaps, about whether there's life after death, questions like that. The third view we might have here might be that you mightn't believe either of those things. You mightn't believe in Christianity, or you mightn't believe in God either. You might be atheistic or agnostic. You're maybe not sure whether you believe in God or not, or whether you should believe in God or not. And those will shape each of you, and will shape me too, in terms of how we approach the sort of topics tonight. So, the divinity of Jesus. Well, obviously, if you're absolutely convinced that there is no God, there is no chance that I will persuade you in the next while this evening, that Jesus is the Son of God. However, the last time that I was here, what I tried to do was to give some reasons for belief in God, especially looking at how that relates to modern science and things like that. So I'm not going to go back over that ground. What I'm going to do tonight is to look at a different topic. And so basically what I would say, in terms of the reasons I gave previously for the existence of God, I'm very convinced that there is a really strong case for belief in God. You might disagree. I would still say, looking at the arguments on both sides, I would say that at the very least, belief in God is reasonable. There are plausible reasons that can be given for belief in God. I would also accept that there are reasons that can be given against belief in God. And so what I'm going to do tonight is to set that aside and say, look, let's, as a starting point, come to this in terms of the reasonableness of belief in God. Okay? So supposing that the existence of God is plausible, how do we approach the sort of question we're looking at this evening? Okay? So that's by way of background. Okay, let's then think about where we're going. What I'm going to try to do is to look at some challenges to Christian belief about Jesus. So, for example, common claims that are made is that the belief that Jesus is God was rejected by early Christians who were later condemned as heretics. That this belief, Jesus being God, was absent from Gospels that were suppressed by church authorities. That it was borrowed from pagan myths, that's where the whole idea came from to start with. That it was invented by Constantine at the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD, and that the belief that Jesus is God was rejected by Jesus himself. So that's roughly where I'm trying to go this evening. So what I want to start with is to look at early belief in Jesus as God. Okay, and here I start with a critic of Christianity. He was a Greek philosopher called Celsus, and writing about 177 AD. So you'll see that I'm looking at a period before that Council of Nicaea. I'll come back to what that is if you're not familiar with it later on. But what I'm looking at is before that council, where it's sometimes claimed that that's when they decided to turn Jesus into a god. Okay. So I'm looking at the period before that. Now, Celsus, as I say, was a critic of Christianity. And he wrote that now, if the Christians worshipped only one God, they might have reason on their side. But as a matter of fact, they worship a man who appeared only recently. They do not consider what they are doing a breach of monotheism. That's belief in one God. Rather, they think it perfectly consistent to worship the great God and to worship his servant as God. Now, Celsus himself believed in God. Okay? But clearly what he's criticizing the Christians for is worshipping God's servant, worshipping somebody who had a man who had appeared only recently. And what's interesting is that he's pointing out that the Christians were not rejecting monotheism. And of course, this is exactly what the Christians were doing. They were indeed embracing monotheism. They believed in one God, and yet at the same time, they worshipped both God and Jesus. And this, of course, is Orthodox Christian belief. They believed that there is one God in three persons, Father, Son, and Spirit. Now, the Trinity is not my topic tonight. I think this one's big enough, okay? So, when they looked at Jesus, they said that Jesus was both human and divine. And that's the bit that I am focusing on. Well, that was a critic of Christianity. Let's now look within Christianity itself. And I'm not going to spend long on this because there's loads of people we could refer to here. But working back from about the end of the second century with Clement of Alexandria, who refers to Jesus as both God and man. These are church fathers and Justin Martyr, an early apologist. But let's take Irenaeus of Lyon, the Bishop of Lyon. Around the same period, he said that the Father is God and the Son is God. Irenaeus wrote a lot about the Trinity, defending belief in the Trinity. Going back to the middle of the second century with Justin Martyr, the Father of the universe is the Son, who also, being the first begotten Word of God, is even God. And Ignatius of Antioch, going right back now to near the start of the second century, wrote in a letter that Jesus, referring to Jesus Christ, our God. Okay. So I don't need to say very much about that. It probably comes as no surprise to you that many Christians in the second century believed in Jesus as God. Can we go back further? Well, what I want to look at here is Jesus as God in the New Testament. Now, again, this might seem obvious to you. It might seem just obvious that, of course, the New Testament claims that Jesus is God. But this has been actually questioned by many people. Is that really what the Bible says? Does it really portray Jesus as being God? Or is this just a sort of they had a high view of who Jesus was, but they didn't actually view him as God. Now, again, I don't have time to go into all the detail on this as to what the Bible says, but let me just refer you to a very good book on the subject called Putting Jesus in His Place. They use this acronym, HANS, that Jesus shares the honours due to God, the attributes of God, the names of God, the deeds that God does, and the seat of God's throne. And in all of these ways, they say the New Testament is building up this picture as to who exactly Jesus is. And they give a very detailed and compelling case that the New Testament is portraying Jesus as God. Just to give you a couple of examples of this, and I won't go through all of these, I'll refer you to the book if you're interested. In terms of the honours of God, so in the book of Revelation we find, for example, that it says to him who sits on the throne, referring to God, and to the Lamb, a way of referring to Jesus, be blessing and honour and glory. And the passage ends, the elders fell down and worshipped. Now, within Judaism, there was only one God, and God was the only one who was to be worshipped. Okay? You didn't worship anybody else as a Jew, going right back to the Ten Commandments, of course. In terms of the attributes of God, again, just to mention one passage referring to that in the New Testament, for in him the whole fullness of deity dwells bodily, from the book of Colossians. And the names of God, well, various names given to Jesus, including Lord, where in some passages that's referring to Old Testament passages that talked about God or Yahweh. And in the New Testament, they use the very same passages referring to Jesus as Lord, where in the Old Testament it was Yahweh. The very same passages. But there are some more direct references to Jesus as God, the most famous one being the first verse of John's Gospel, that the Word was with God and the Word was God. The Word, of course, being Jesus, as we find a few verses later. Okay, so you get the idea that the New Testament is portraying Jesus as God. Now, the interesting thing about this is that everybody has agreed that the New Testament was written in the first century. Okay. And so now we have moved from back from the Council of Nicaea, 325, through the second century, now back into the first century, and we find that Jesus is worshipped and followed as God. This is what the Christians believed. Well, let's then move on quickly. We'll come back to a few of those points a little bit later. Orthodoxy and heresy. The claim has been made by many people, including not least the new atheists, that the Gospels that we find in the New Testament are only a sample of the Gospels that could or should have been there. And so although Jesus might be portrayed as God in the New Testament itself is giving us a biased account. So Richard Dawkins in The God Delusion writes that the four Gospels that made it into the official canon were chosen more or less arbitrarily out of a larger sample of at least a dozen, all of the status of legends. Or Christopher Hitchens, in his book, God Is Not Great, these scrolls referring to Gnostic Gospels were of the same period and provenance as many of the subsequently canonical and authorized Gospels. Well, do these claims stand up to scrutiny? In terms of how the Christian community arrived at what we now call the New Testament, and here I'm overlapping a little bit with some of the things Stephen mentioned last time round, if you were here. So again, I'm not going to dwell on this too much. But the basic idea is that the church didn't get together in those early centuries and organize a council or something like that to come up with an authoritative list of books. That didn't happen. Rather, what happened was that over time, the church just found that they were using certain books within their community, in their study, in their preaching, and so forth, in their writing. Certain books were being used. And when they started to think then about what books were part of all of this, there were three factors that played important roles. And the basic idea being that because of these three factors, the books that were ended up in our New Testament selected themselves, essentially. It wasn't a group of people who sat down to select them and to rule out others. The three main criteria were apostolicity. Was it written by an apostle or an associate of one? Orthodoxy, did it conform to established Christian belief up to that point? And Catholicity, had it been in widespread and continuous acceptance and use? When we come then to some of the Gnostic Gospels, what we find is that, let's take first of all the apostolicity. Were they written by apostles or their associates? And the answer to this is simply no. I mean, there are, sometimes we can kind of get the impression, well, these are all just matters of debate and there are things that sort of sensible people disagree about. But actually, in some cases, that's not true. And so on this case, there are clear answers. Okay. So when we look at the Gnostic Gospels, the vast majority of them are dated much later. And this is a consensus amongst people, whether historians, whether they're Christian or not. In the vast majority of cases, I'll mention an exception in a minute. But if we take the Gospel of Philip, you might have heard of some of these, the Gospel of Philip or the Gospel of Mary or the Gospel of Thomas. Well, there's an enormous consensus that these books, and for good reason too, based on evidence about the writing and the sort of ideas that they present, were written much later. So Philip, for example, the Gospel of Philip in the 3rd century, Mary, second half of the 2nd century. And other Gnostic Gospels could be put in the same sort of period. By contrast, everybody agrees that the four Gospels we have were written in the first century. And again, this is not just a Christian viewpoint. There's a consensus across the board based on the evidence that these books, the four Gospels we have, Matthew, Mark, and Luke and John, were written in the first century. Mark is generally considered to be the earliest, probably written in the 60s. Matthew and Luke, probably in the 70s or so, John being the latest in the 90s, but all before 100 AD. Now, when you look at that, Philip, Mary, and Thomas are not on the radar given these dates of apostolicity. Okay. They were just written too late. There is some debate about Thomas. The vast majority of people will date it somewhere around where I've placed it in this timeline. Some people will claim that it goes earlier. But Thomas, in fact, is not a gospel like the four we have in the New Testament. It's just 114 sayings. And in fact, many of these are very closely related to things we do have in the four Gospels. So actually, even if we were to incorporate Thomas, it wouldn't change things all that much. Provided, of course, we didn't just dismiss the four Gospels. But here's the irony. People often just dismiss the four Gospels and think, well, they suppress the truth about all these others. But the four Gospels, and again, there's an enormous consensus about this, are our most reliable sources of information about Jesus. Whether you accept every word of them or not, that's not my argument. That was more the focus of the last topic last month. But they are reliable at least to some extent. They give us some information about the historical Jesus. Here's a table produced by an American academic, Professor Tim McGrew, relating to the Gospels and to the Book of Acts. And what he has done is to go through a whole lot of important people, basically, in the history of the church, church fathers and various other people, and look at whether they in their writings are approving of the Gospels, either quoting them in an approving way or in some other way affirming them. And he does the same for a number of the other Gospels as well. And you can see from this table that we've got loads and loads of ticks up here for our four Gospels and Acts, and virtually none for a whole bunch of other Gospels down here. One of the reasons for this is that many of these other Gospels were just written later. Okay, so that's one factor. But they just weren't in widespread use. Remember the Catholicity? They just weren't in widespread use within the Christian community. So, in fact, we see that these sort of criteria about how the documents, how the books that were included were selected, historically, I think, actually, it stacks up pretty well. There really isn't much of a case for any of the alternative Gospels at all. Okay, let me then move swiftly on to Christianity and mystery religions. Now, let me pause just before I go to this. A lot of the topics that we're looking at this evening, I would say, are sort of modern myths about Christianity. Okay, this is called Skeptic's Corner. Tonight, I'm the skeptic. A lot of these modern claims about Christianity, just there is no evidence for them. They just don't stack up. They don't stand up to historical evidence. And this is recognized by experts across the board on a lot of these topics. Now, I will, when I get to a topic near the end where there is more disagreement, I will mention that. But when we look at whether people believed in Jesus as God, as we've already talked about, or the Gospels and their dating and which Gospels should have been included, whether there was some conspiracy here, there really is no serious disagreement, and nowhere is that stronger than on the next two, Christianity and mystery religions. And yet we have Richard Dawkins claiming that all the essential features of the Jesus legend are borrowed, every last one of them, from other religions already in existence in the Mediterranean and Near East region. Now, this view was popular in the sort of late 19th, early 20th century, but it has since been discredited. It's a view known as the history of religions, history of religions school of thought, and it just has been rejected that Christianity based its ideas on pagan myths, such as Isis and Osiris and Mithra, two of the most common ones, but a number of others as well. Yet despite the fact that there is just no historical evidence for this. This is a very common criticism. The new atheists pick up on it, as we see here, but on almost any internet discussion, you will find this is how sometimes people criticize Christianity. Oh, they borrowed the idea of the virgin birth or the resurrection or baptism or the idea of rebirth or celebrating the 25th of December. They just borrowed these wholesale from pagan myths, kind of end of story. And so this is a very common approach to these things. And here I just want to say one thing about it. How do we go about forming our beliefs about these kinds of things? And this, I think, relates to our worldviews. Do we approach these questions? We've already got our worldview in place, and we will just go to the internet and find any kind of information we can to back up our beliefs. Now, I'm not just having a go at the new atheists here. What about us as Christians? How do we approach this? Do we sometimes do the same thing? Do we say, well, we know what we believe and we'll go and get anything we can off the internet just to back up our own beliefs? And what I want to say is we've got to approach these issues, I think, seriously and with integrity and look at the evidence for and against our own positions. And on this one, I think the evidence is pretty clear. So let me just say a little bit about it, about the mystery religions. So first of all, they're polytheistic. They're stories about multiple gods. And here already we have a huge difference from Christianity. Christianity is born in a Jewish context, monotheistic, as we've already seen. Okay? So that's a huge and important difference. Also, these religions are related to the annual cycle of birth and death in nature. In fact, they're not purporting to deal with historical events. They are myths. They're myths, ancient myths about the gods. Okay? And finally, they're secret ceremonies or mysteries to acquire secret knowledge of the gods. So you had to be part in, you had to be in on it. You had to be initiated in the right sort of group to know God, according to this. Whereas in Christianity, it was public. It was about something that had happened publicly, the shameful death, the crucifixion of Jesus. Okay, so we get a big contrast here. Now, let me give you an idea just about one of these myths. And it was an idea that it comes from Osiris, okay, the myth of Osiris. And the basic idea was that Osiris was an Egyptian god. And his wife was Isis. But Osiris was murdered by his brother. And in fact, he and his brother and his wife were all children of another god. So you see, we're really in the context of polytheism, totally different from Judaism. And what happens is that after he's murdered, well, there are different versions of the myth. In one version, his body's thrown into the Nile. And this is important then because the Nile, the Nile is then treated as sacred, for example. But one of the links that is sometimes made, because his body is thrown in the water, people then describe this sometimes in Christian terminology. They talk about this as baptism and say, oh, we've got a parallel with baptism. But there's no mention of baptism. And you know, our terminology can be like that with regard to birth and rebirth and things like that as well. Our terminology depends on the context. So this afternoon, I'm sure a few of you might have been watching the rugby match, and there was a point in that match where you might have said, look, and I think I did probably say something to one of my children like this, Ireland are dead and buried. You could just see, I mean, when they lost that scrum early on in the game, you thought, you know where this is going. And But then you might say, oh, well, they've come back to life now. Now, clearly we're using that in a metaphorical sense. And I'm not saying that that's exactly what's going on with these religions, but something like that is true. They're using some of this terminology in very different ways. And so we've got to be careful about then just reading that into Christianity, which I think is what happens. So I've already mentioned that they're based on myths. Sorry, I should have said one more bit about Osiris. So what happened was, in another account of the myth, his body was dismembered and sent off to all parts of Egypt. And his wife then got all these parts back together to sort of reconstruct her husband. Okay? Remarkable stuff. So, but what happened was that she got this his sort of body back together so that posthumously he could conceive a child. And their child then was another god. Now, the interesting thing about this, it's not even clear from the myth itself, never mind, I mean, nobody, it seems, thought of this as having anything to do with the real physical world. This was a story about the gods. But it's not even clear from the myth whether he came back to life. It was only that he sort of fulfilled his purpose of conceiving a child, and then he sort of disappears from the story. So the differences are enormous. First of all, on myths not based in history, whereas Christianity, whether you believe it to be true or not, the early Christians were claiming that this was based on historical events. Christianity was read into the mystery religions. There's no pre-Christian mention of rebirth, for example. The similarities are often superficial. And just because there's similarity, it doesn't mean there's dependence. I mean, you can find some similarities between almost all religions. Religions are dealing with big questions about the nature of reality, about whether there is something or someone out there, whether there's life after death, what our purpose is. It's not surprising that in religions you're going to find some similarities, but that doesn't mean dependence. And the last one I think is very interesting, that insofar as there is dependence, it's probably the other way around. Because these myths developed over time, and the latest forms of some of them do bear some more marks of Christianity. But that seems to be the latest versions, and arguably what has happened is Christianity has been successful. It's attracting a lot of followers in the Roman Empire, and some people have sort of updated their myths to try to track onto it. So I would say that on this, and again, the scholarship on this is very clear. This is not the context for early Christianity. Let me give just a couple of comments on this with regard to the resurrection. N.T. Wright wrote an enormous book on the resurrection of the Son of God, defending the resurrection of Jesus. And what he does is he carries out a huge overview of similar ideas about death and resurrection, or similar concepts in both Judaism and in other cultures as well. And he writes that insofar as the ancient non-Jewish world had a Bible, its Old Testament was Homer. And insofar as Homer has anything to say about resurrection, he's quite blunt. It doesn't happen. Now, this is interesting because sometimes we get the impression, well, all these ancient people, they would have believed anything. But that's just not true historically. People back then knew that people just didn't rise from the dead. And when the evidence is looked at, they might have believed in the gods doing all sorts of amazing things, but to believe that normal humans were resurrected, it's not there. Now, one of the interesting things about this is that not only is it not there, but nobody would have expected it. Nobody actually expected the mummies to get up, walk about, and resume normal living. Nobody in that world would have wanted such a thing. Because for a lot of people in the Roman Empire and the Greek-speaking world, they would have viewed life after death as the sort of immortality of the soul. That there might have been indeed some kind of life after death, but it wasn't coming back to your normal body. In fact, you were meant to be going on to something much better. And so in the myth of Osiris, for example, it's very important about the embalming process, because this is part of the rituals within the practice of these religions. Let's go on to another one, the virgin birth, that Christianity, again, has just borrowed this from some of these ancient stories. Well, when you look at the ancient stories, they're based on the love of gods for mortal women. It's gods like Zeus who come down in human form or some other physical form to impregnate a woman. That's what's going on. It's very, very different from the accounts we find in the New Testament. Bart Ehrman, who certainly he doesn't defend in any way Orthodox Christianity or anything like the virgin birth. But in surveying some of these stories, he says in none of these stories of the divine humans born from the union of a god and mortal is the mortal a virgin. That's kind of the point. The gods come down in human form. This is one of the ways the Christian stories of Jesus differ from those of other divine humans in the ancient world. The virgin birth of Jesus, is it reasonable? I'm going to skip over that for the moment. We might come back to it if we have time later on. Let me just make a brief comment, though, about miracles. Of course, let's go back to worldviews. If you're convinced that there's no God, then it doesn't make any sense to believe that miracles occurred. But if it's even possible that there's a God, then the only way to work it out is to look at the evidence. Okay? It's not something that can just be rejected out of hand. And what I would suggest is that when it comes to the miracles of the New Testament, we've got to look at the evidence. We've got to look at what the case is for them. And I would suggest that by far the most important miracle concerns the resurrection of Jesus. And here I refer you to N.T. Wright's book that I mentioned, and there's some other very good work defending the historical case. And when I was looking into this a few years ago, I was kind of shocked to see just how good the case is, based not on just taking the Gospels as sort of gospel truth, but just on historical evidence. That's maybe a topic that should be pursued sometime in future, but not tonight. Okay. Let's go to another myth, and this concerns the Council of Nicaea. The idea was that, or is sometimes portrayed, that this idea that Jesus is God was invented by the emperor, the Roman emperor Constantine, in the 4th century at the Council of Nicaea. What had happened was in 312, Constantine converted to Christianity. And Christianity was then sort of embraced as the religion of the empire. Now, there's a lot that could probably be said about that. I wouldn't point to that as being one of the high points of Christianity. In fact, before that, Christianity had been persecuted and spread rapidly. Once it's sort of got the trappings of power, all sorts of things begin to happen, and that's another whole story about the subsequent history of Christianity. But whatever the rights and wrongs of all of that, that doesn't give us the right to believe things that don't stand up to the historical evidence on this. Let's think about what happened. The idea is that he had this council, he got all the bishops together, and he sort of told them what to believe. And they forged this belief that Jesus was God. But as we've already seen, Christians had been worshipping Jesus as God for over 200 years. And what happened was that Arius believed Jesus was a created being, and this caused a dispute in the city of Alexandria. Arius' beliefs were sort of similar to the modern-day Jehovah's Witnesses. He believed that Jesus was an incredibly high and important being, but not God. Constantine summoned the bishops to a council to resolve this. Now, the Christians, many of them had been persecuted at the hands of Diocletian, Constantine's predecessor, and many other of the Roman emperors, and they were brought to sort this out. Now, Constantine wasn't particularly interested in getting a particular view. What he was interested in was a consensus. That was important for the running of the empire. And so he summoned them to resolve the matter. What happened then was that people had different views about how to understand Jesus being God and man. Christians had believed that he was both God and man, but actually explaining how you could explain that, how you could understand it, that was a different matter. And so, anyway, they were called to this council. And the views of Arius were put forward, and the majority of the bishops were in shock. One historian writing about this wrote the following: some of the bishops were holding their heads over their ears and shouting for someone to stop the blasphemies. One bishop near Eusebius stepped forward and grabbed the manuscript out of his hands, threw it on the floor, and stomped on it. A riot broke out among the bishops and was stopped only by the emperor's command. Why? Why did this riot break out? Many of these bishops, as I just said, had been persecuted for their faith. They weren't coming here to let the emperor tell them what to believe. And when they heard that the view being proposed was that Jesus was a created being, they were scandalized. They were absolutely aghast that this should even be on the table. And so the conversation continued, or started maybe at this point, and the views of Arius were rejected. Constantine, was he pushing this orthodox line? Not one bit of it. Later on, Constantine actually converted to the Arian view. And it was the orthodox view that was almost being rejected. Except that people like Athanasius, who stood firm against Constantine and other Roman emperors, held out for the orthodox viewpoint. Okay, so we come to the final bit, and my time is nearly up, so that's okay. Who did Jesus think he was? What we've done is we've gone from the Council of Nicaea, which we've just been talking about. We've looked back in the second century. We've looked back to Ignatius at the start of the second century, back to the New Testament, where Jesus is God, as we saw from the work that I referred to earlier. But can we go back earlier than that? And we can. The early worship of Jesus dates back very early indeed. One scholar on this from the University of Edinburgh wrote a book in the last, I think it was 2003 maybe, Larry Hurtado, and he says that the emergence of devotion to Jesus was a veritable big bang, an explosively rapid and immensely substantial development in the earliest stage of the Christian movement. And he, along with all other scholars, have established that Jesus was being worshipped in the Christian community certainly within the first 20 years after the crucifixion. Okay, it wasn't a later development at all. Another historian talks about the fact that the earliest sermon that we have, the earliest hymn that we have, the earliest prayers, the earliest comments from critics of Christianity all portray Jesus as being worshipped as Lord and God. Okay. That is our historical evidence. What are we to make of this? Well, C.S. Lewis wrote an article, What Are We to Make of Jesus Christ? And in it he wrote his followers were all Jews. That is, they belonged to that nation which of all others was most convinced that there was only one God, that there could not possibly be another. It was very odd that this horrible invention, and he's talking about Jesus as God, about a religious leader should grow up among the one people in the whole earth least likely to make such a mistake. So why did it happen? Why, within a few years of Jesus' crucifixion, were people worshipping Jesus? And I would say that the best explanation of this is due to Jesus having claimed to be divine and to belief in the resurrection. What happened that changed the views of these Orthodox Jews? Because that's where Christianity started. What happened for Jews to start worshipping a human being? That's an astonishing change, and it requires a serious explanation. And I would say that those two factors are key. Well, this last one, about whether Jesus claimed to be divine, this is a huge topic in its own right, and it's one that I don't have time to go into here tonight. There's a whole area of study about this, the historical Jesus. Not looking at what people believed about him, but what he actually claimed himself. Now, what I want to say very briefly in my last few minutes about this is that when we look at the historical Jesus, we find a great change has taken place in discussions about this. People in the past might have portrayed it all as legends and myths. Now, people, from whatever perspective, look at this in terms of the Jewish context in which Jesus lived. Jesus was a Jew, and that is the way he is to be understood. And here I want to make some claims, and I mean, I'm accepting on this point there are different viewpoints out there in the sort of scholarly community on this, unlike most of the other topics that I've addressed this evening. But let me just mention a few lines of evidence that have convinced a lot of people that Jesus at least thought of himself in this way. That he thought of himself as the Messiah and both the Son of Man and the Son of God in unique senses. Why did belief in the Messiah, Jesus as the Messiah, come about? When we look to the origins of Christianity, we find that Jesus is crucified as King of the Jews. And people are agreed that this wouldn't have been made up because this wasn't a Christian way of talking about Jesus, King of the Jews. So where did they get this idea? This is what he was crucified for. And the suggestion is that based on claims he makes, he's pointing to himself as the Messiah. Indeed, Bart Ehrman, who I mentioned earlier, believes that Jesus thought of himself as the Messiah, even though he rejects, of course, Orthodox Christianity. Let me just mention a few more. We can come back to some of them in the questions if you wish. He believed that in him God's kingdom had come. It wasn't just in his teaching, but in everything he did. He believed that he performed certain miracles, cast out demons and the like. Now, whatever we make of those, whatever historians make of these, Jesus claimed that in doing these things, God's kingdom had come. Not just through his teaching or at this time, but in him, by what he was doing. He claimed to speak and act with divine authority, to be able to forgive sins. Again, this is one of the things that goes back to the historical Jesus that he claimed to, in Mark chapter 2, we find Jesus forgiving somebody's sins. Now, if I forgive you for a sin you've committed against me, that's one thing. But if I forgive you for a sin that you've committed against somebody else, well, that's an altogether different thing. I've just no right to do that. And the Jews believed that the only person who had the right to do that was God. And yet, that's what Jesus did. When I talk about divine authority, in the Sermon on the Mount, for example, the rabbis would have said, they would have referred to some other authority, like from the Old Testament, Moses. What does Jesus do? He refers to the Old Testament and he says, "You've heard that it was said, but I say to you." And Jews, when they look at this, they say, who did Jesus think he is? Making these sort of pronouncements, extending the law on his own authority, not based on what other people did. And finally, that he claimed to determine people's eternal destiny. That if you accepted him, God would accept you. Or if you rejected him, you'd be rejected. These are startling claims for an ordinary human being to make. For someone who, could we really think of somebody making these claims as just being an ordinary human, a good teacher or something like that? So, in conclusion, belief in Jesus as God was not invented by Constantine. It was not borrowed from pagan myths. Reliable rival gospels were not suppressed. Belief in Jesus as God goes back to the New Testament in the first century. Worship of Jesus is found in the earliest Christian practices. And all of this, I would suggest, is consistent with the claims of the historical Jesus himself. One of the things that passages about Jesus being the Messiah is that Jesus asked his followers, "Who do people say that I am?" They give various answers. Now, we could look at what various people say Jesus is. We've seen some of the things that people say Jesus is. And I would suggest that a lot of these simply don't stand up to historical scrutiny at all. But this is not a purely academic question. Jesus confronts us. And if we think about the purpose of our lives, if you're here and you're thinking about belief in God, you're thinking about Christianity or religion in general, one of the questions that confronts every one of us is, who is Jesus? And after he had asked his followers, his disciples, who do people say that I am? He asked them a further one. Who do you say that I am? And I would say Jesus still asks each one of us that question.